the third case this morning, Ellison v. Icivo. Ms. Beyer?
May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Lindsay Beyer. I represent Petitioner Appellant Lorenzo Ellison on appeal from denial of his petition for habeas corpus. Mr. Ellison raises two issues on appeal, ineffective assistance of counsel and prosecutorial misconduct. I'd like to begin with Mr. Ellison's ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The State Court's denial of Mr. Ellison's ineffective assistance of counsel claim was an unreasonable application of Strickland v. Washington in two ways. First, the State Courts unreasonably ignored Mr. Ellison's need to rebut the state expert's testimony that whoever shook Quincy King did so until his arms were tired and pained. Such testimony effectively made the difference between first-degree murder, for which Mr. Ellison is serving a 60-year sentence, and involuntary manslaughter. By focusing only on whether an expert would have testified that Quincy King's death was not caused by shaken infant syndrome, the court unreasonably ignored the impact of the state expert's inflammatory state of mind testimony. According to an expert affidavit presented at Mr. Ellison's post-conviction hearing, the state expert's testimony that the perpetrator would have had to shake the infant until his arms were exhausted is purely speculative. Under Strickland, counsel's performance may be deficient for failing to investigate even one crucial aspect of the defense. The state post-conviction court unreasonably failed to consider the available rebuttal testimony, which went not to how Quincy King died, but to the state of mind of the person who shook him.
But his defense wasn't that I just shook the baby a little. His defense was that somebody else must have done it. Isn't that right?
Mr. Ellison presented both theories at trial. He did say there were statements submitted at trial, which he had given to the police officers immediately after Quincy King's death, that said, I was playing with the baby. We were bouncing the baby on the bed. He stopped breathing. I don't know, maybe I shook him too hard. I did shake him to try and get him to start breathing again. So there were two competing theories, whether possibly the baby's mother or Roberto Smith could have caused the death, or whether Mr. Ellison had in fact simply been too rough with the baby. The second way that the state courts unreasonably applied Strickland v. Washington in this case was by speculating that trial counsel had in fact investigated potential experts. To construct strategic reasons why counsel did not present expert testimony, or to speculate that counsel in fact did investigate experts but could find none, was unreasonable in this case because
Attorney Pantoga, did he ever testify as to why he did not call an expert?
He did not.
He was not offered as a witness in any post-conviction procedures.
He was not, Mr.
And
Ellison.
Isn't it the petitioner's burden at this point to show ineffective assistance of counsel? So he has to show that this is ineffective, constitutionally ineffective.
Yes, Your Honor, but here we also have Mr. Ellison's testimony about his communications with counsel, and we also have the pretrial proceeding transcripts that demonstrate over and over again that trial counsel was not investigating the potential experts in this case.
Well, we have that on previous counsel who said he's trying to contact the family for money. But when Mr. Pantoga took over, didn't the judge explain that there are other ways to do this?
The judge had explained to Mr. Vishny, the first trial counsel, that if the problem was money, there were options with the assistance of the court. Mr. Vishny wasted approximately 3 months basically throwing his hands up in the air saying, we don't have money for an expert. When Mr. Pantoga took over the case, he repeatedly told the court that he did not have time to prepare. He had an intervening murder trial that was set to go to trial immediately preceding Mr. Ellison's trial. And he repeatedly told the court, I'm not ready because of this other trial. I don't have
time.
Didn't he
ask for a week extension or an extension, and wasn't one granted at his request?
The court did move the trial to the second week of trial call. Mr. Pantoga had an April 22nd murder trial that was not Mr. Ellison's trial. He was set for trial April 26th for Mr. Ellison. The court did, upon his request, move the trial to the following week.
Did he ever say, I need more time to get an expert?
Yes, repeatedly. He repeatedly told the court, I'm not ready. I haven't been able to locate an expert. I haven't been contacting experts because of this intervening murder trial. So this is the only statements that we have directly from Mr. Pantoga about why there was not an expert. And then coupled with that, we have Mr. Ellison's post-conviction hearing testimony saying Mr. Pantoga said that he also didn't have money for an expert and then never told me that he contacted anyone or investigated. And in fact, the closing argument of Mr. Pantoga demonstrates that he thought that there were experts out there that would be helpful. He didn't know how to use them. He improperly tried to reference articles and reports of other experts during closing argument.
Well, the expert that you put in by affidavit now, he doesn't really, he agrees it would take a great deal of force to cause the death of this child. He says it's mere speculation whether one's arms would get tired shaking the baby before the death would be caused. Is that correct?
Yes. And I think that
The arms getting tired shaking the baby, that was trial testimony. It almost sounds like a metaphor, or maybe not a metaphor, but it sounds like almost hyperbole, trying to make the point that it takes a great deal of force to shake a baby to death.
The state's...
My point is that you wouldn't have gotten an expert to rebut that testimony before you heard it, and if the only expert you were going to get was going to agree that it would take a great deal of force to shake a baby to death, how would this expert have helped?
Well, there are plenty of reasons in this case that defense counsel would have needed an expert, even if he was going to concede that Quincy King's cause of death was shaken infant syndrome. One of the theories at trial was that there were numerous adults who had access to Quincy King. Shaken infant syndrome can be caused over a period of days or even months, which was admitted by state's experts.
So that wasn't in dispute. You wouldn't need your own expert to establish that. Would you, if the state's own expert agreed with that?
Dr. Glimp agreed with that. Dr. Jensen stated that he thought in this case the injuries were more immediate, which would have required rebuttal testimony by defense.
We don't know if he could have got. I mean, you don't have any expert testimony on that issue, though, that you've offered through affidavit or otherwise.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think in this case because the stakes were first-degree murder versus involuntary manslaughter, it was crucial for the defense to present their own witness because there was very little else that the state could have presented regarding Mr. Ellison's state of mind. If the court has no further questions, I'll retain the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Saber.
Good morning, Your Honors. Erica Seaburn from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. I'll begin with the Strickland issue. The state courts here did not unreasonably apply Strickland in rejecting Mr. Ellison's claim. Although he had counsel at his post-conviction evidentiary hearing and was given a full evidentiary hearing on this point, he did not carry his factual burden to develop the record to show either prong of Strickland. First, the record does not support his claim of deficient performance. Now, the record reflects, based on the colloquies during the pretrial proceedings, that Mr. Pantoga, his trial counsel, knew about the importance of getting an expert witness. The first time that Mr. Pantoga appeared on February 24th, this was the same day that his first trial counsel, Mr. Vishny, withdrew. The court, sua sponte, gave Mr. Pantoga more time to find an expert witness. The second time that Mr. Pantoga appeared, which was March 31st, he says that he needed another week in order to find an expert witness. That ended up pushing the trial date back by another week. And then at the final pretrial call on April 14th, there was no mention of more time of needing an expert witness at all. There's nothing in that record to indicate that Mr. Pantoga forgot about getting an expert witness. The record, in fact, indicates that he realized that this could be a helpful line of investigation for him. The fact that the record is silent on why Mr. Pantoga didn't present an expert witness favors the state's position because petitioner did not meet his post-conviction burden to show what Mr. Pantoga's reasons were. Mr. Pantoga didn't testify at the post-conviction evidentiary hearing. They didn't obtain an affidavit from Mr. Pantoga indicating what his reasons were.
Because the record is silent on whether he did or did not talk to an expert?
The record is silent on that point, Your Honor. The only evidence that Mr. Ellison presented at his evidentiary hearing was his own testimony about his conversations with Mr. Pantoga, and frankly, that testimony was not credible. That's part of Respondent's Exhibit P, which was supplemented in the record in this court.
He did have that affidavit also, though, didn't he?
He had the affidavit from Dr. Lazaritz.
Talk about that. Doesn't that impeach the state's expert at trial?
Well, Your Honor, that goes to the prejudice prong, and the proffered affidavit from Dr. Lazaritz, in fact, shows that he substantially agreed with the state's expert, Dr. Jensen, that the amount of force needed to cause the baby's injuries was very great. Now, it seems that they disagreed on the arms tired comment, which I would characterize as an illustration of the very great force. Dr. Lazaritz doesn't disagree that the amount of force needed to cause these injuries was very great. Bringing on Dr. Lazaritz as a rebuttal witness would, in fact, have harmed petitioner's cause. The first question that they would have asked him was, you disagree about the arms tired comment? Yes. The second question, you agree with Dr. Jensen about everything else he testified about? Apparently, Dr. Lazaritz did. He agreed that the amount of force was very great, and the affidavit does not point to any other point of disagreement with the whole of Dr. Jensen's testimony. Bringing on a defense expert who was only going to reinforce what the state's expert said could not have been a helpful strategy. It could not have a reasonable could not change the result.
Or what, I should ask it this way. Was there evidence that that injuries had occurred over, at least not just that day, but other days?
Your Honor, Dr. Jensen was cross-examined on these points by counsel. Among the points that counsel cross-examined Dr. Jensen on were whether or not the child could live for some period of time after the shaking event, and Dr. Jensen testified yes. They would not know for sure. Dr. Jensen also was cross-examined on the point that there could conceivably have been several incidents of force used on the child to cause the shaken infant syndrome. And counsel also elicited from Dr. Jensen on cross-examination that there would be no way of telling from the injuries whether the person who inflicted them was male or female. So in that way, counsel's cross-examination of Dr. Jensen effectively rebutted the testimony on the points at which it could have been rebutted. Bringing on Dr. Lazaritz would not have been helpful. As this court, and as back, moving back to the performance prong briefly, because Pantoga didn't testify or give an affidavit, as the court recognized in Johnson v. Leftus, if the record doesn't reveal the reason that counsel failed to present a witness because petitioner never asked for the reason during post-conviction, the state court's not unreasonable to presume a strategic choice. The presumption of competence remains with Mr. Pantoga here. Briefly on the mens rea point, the petitioner argues that the expert was needed because the arms tired testimony went to the vital issue of mens rea in terms of knowingness for murder versus recklessness for involuntary manslaughter. Again, the evidence is that Mr. Pantoga understood the need for an expert. The state's theory to prove mens rea was based on the amount of force, which was compelling evidence of intent, and both Dr. Jensen and Dr. Lazaritz agreed on this point. Dr. Lazaritz's affidavit says repeatedly, twice, that the amount of force needed was very great. Dr. Jensen indicates that the laceration of the baby's corpus callosum in his brain indicated violent shaking, that the rib fractures indicated a large amount of force. This testimony is indicative of mens rea, even without the arms tired comment. In addition, petitioner himself testified at trial that he knew that the baby was fragile and could be hurt easily, and the petitioner's mother testified that she had told petitioner in the past not to hurt the child. If the court has no other questions on the Strickland issue, I'd like to briefly touch on the Darden claim. Petitioner here argues that the state courts unreasonably applied Darden, but Darden itself does not recognize the particular comments at issue here as improper. Thus, there's no clearly established Supreme Court precedent to look to in determining whether the state court's decision was reasonable. But even if Darden had referred to this type of comment, the factors still weigh against a finding of an unfair trial. The comment here took place over one half page of trial transcript at the end of the prosecutor's 26 pages of closing argument. At that point, there was still the defense argument to come, as well as 10 pages of prosecutorial rebuttal. As the Supreme Court recognized in Donnelly, the court should not lightly infer that a jury sitting through a lengthy closing argument is going to draw the most damaging interpretation from an ambiguous remark by the prosecutor. Also, because it occurred during the prosecutor's closing as opposed to the rebuttal, and there was still much more argument to come at that point, we shouldn't assume that this comment was going to stick in the jury's minds during the deliberation and cause them to deliberate in an unfair way. As for the other Darden factors, the jury here was properly instructed that the arguments were not evidence, that the verdict should be based only on the evidence, and that the defendant was entitled to the presumption of innocence throughout. As this court recognized in Bartlett v. Battaglia, closing arguments carry less weight with the jury than the instructions from the trial court. The defendant had the opportunity to rebut this point in his own argument, which occurred directly after the prosecutor's closing. The defense attorney could have made an explicit statement about the prosecutor's improper remark, but he chose not to do so. That would be a strategic choice, but under Darden, we look at whether or not he had the opportunity to rebut, and he did. Finally, of course, the most important factor in a Darden analysis is the strength of the evidence against him, and here there was compelling evidence of guilt based on two confessions, one handwritten by the petitioner, one that was typed by the police and signed by the petitioner after he read it. There was the physical evidence and the testimony from Dr. Jensen, and there was the testimony from the baby's mother, Jackie King, and from Roberto Smith, the petitioner's roommate. Based on this evidence and the other Darden factors, petitioner has not shown that the prosecutor's comment was so egregious as to infect the entire trial and deprive him of due process. Unless the court has any other questions, we urge the court to affirm the decision of the district court and deny relief.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
R.
I'd like to address the Darden argument at this time. This court's precedent makes clear that under Darden, it is always improper for the prosecution to suggest that the defendant is guilty by the mere fact that he is being prosecuted. We have a situation where you have a prosecutor who's in a special role, and a prosecutor in a criminal proceeding may strike hard blows, but he may not strike foul ones. The state is correct that the most important factor for prejudice under Darden is the weight of the evidence against the defendant. This case hinged upon a credibility determination. You have Jacqueline King and Roberto Smith providing conflicting testimony regarding the events surrounding Quincy King's death. The conviction of Mr. Ellison relied upon a determination that it was Ellison and not King or Smith or anyone else who had shaken this baby. The prosecutor told the jury that they know the answer to this question, and they know it because the state authorities decided to prosecute Mr. Ellison, not Smith and not King. In this situation, any attempts by the defense counsel to rebut these statements were not fruitful because the court had not clearly sustained objections to the prosecution's improper line of questioning. For all these reasons, I would ask this court to reverse the district court's denial of Mr. Ellison's petition for habeas corpus.
Ms. Beyer, you were appointed, and you're firm appointed to represent the defendant in this case?
Yes, I was.
Thank you for your vigorous and very good representation of your client.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.